this is kind of where the center of gravity for Christianity was at the time. You've got your Eastern Christianity, Eastern Orthodoxy, over here in the Byzantine Empire. And you've got Western Christianity, which is now this hodgepodge of nations here in the West. And they're starting to look a little more familiar to us now in this part of history. You've got Norway, Sweden, and Denmark up north. Those are essentially the same as they are today. England, Scotland, Ireland. France, a little bit of France anyway there. And this big Holy Roman Empire, where we would now put Germany. The borders of the Holy Roman Empire kind of expanded and contracted several times over this period. Didn't always reach this far down into Italy, but it was really the major Christian power in Western Europe at the time. Over here in Spain, you have some Christian nations, Aragon and Castile, but at the beginning of our period, Spain is still pretty much entirely ruled by a Muslim caliphate. And little by little during this period, the Muslims get pushed out of Spain. But that's the picture we're looking at. And I want to start by talking about the Vikings. The Vikings, they really began making their incursions back a little bit before the time period in which we're starting with today. Back by 900, they were already raiding from Norway and Denmark, raiding down to Scotland. One of their first big raids was against the monastery of Lindisfarne, which we talked about last time, that great Celtic missional monastery that's here on the eastern coast of Scotland. And the Vikings just start raiding everywhere. But one of the things to know about the Vikings is that they didn't just raid, they also settled. They were almost like a colonial power in this period. They settled pretty heavily along this northern shore of France. That's why it is called Normandy. It's named after the Northmen who settled there. And so William the Conqueror, who was one of the Normans from Normandy, he and his guys had a lot of Viking roots because the Vikings came and settled in this area. And most of them weren't Christians when they started raiding, but within a couple hundred years, they had been pretty well, highly Christianized. In fact, there are funny stories about the Vikings coming and raiding along this territory because, you know, they're looking to get interesting things, snap up what they can here and there. And one of them discovered somewhere along the way that if you get baptized as a Christian, the Christians will give you a free white robe. It was part of the baptismal ceremony. You get this nice white robe. And they thought that was great. And so every place they stopped, they would ask to be baptized again so that they could get another robe for themselves. Well, they settled this area of Normandy, but they don't just stop there. They're everywhere. Like, they come down here through the Baltic Sea. It's not on the map, but this area that's now Ukraine, they are pretty heavily settled in there. They come around the other way, this what's called the Kingdom of Sicily, down here on the bottom of Italy, Sicily and southern Italy. Sometimes you'll also see it called the Kingdom of Naples. That was conquered and settled by Norse Viking raiders. They didn't displace the local population, but they were in charge of it for a while. Even here in the Byzantine Empire, the elite bodyguard of the Byzantine emperor was a group of Viking warriors who kind of came down and conscripted themselves into imperial service with the Byzantine Empire. So they're starting to spread all their way around. And at the same time, you know, as they're settling, they're becoming Christianized. Also, missionaries are continuing to go up into Sweden and Norway. And there's one very prominent Norse king named Harald, who kind of completed the Christianization of Norway right around the year 1100, if I remember right. But you also are entering a new period with the rise of these new monarchies, centralized monarchies in England, when William the Conqueror comes over and establishes his kingdom there over the Saxons who were there. You get the beginning of this new English state. You have the rise of France. You have the Holy Roman Empire persisting. It's really a new season in Western Christian history, contrasting with what had come before, where it was sort of a lot of tribal kings. And so now you've got sort of political states who wield enough power that you're going to get friction building up between them and the power of the Pope in the Roman Catholic Church. And so this is the period in which you start to see some of these tensions build up, not only between these states up here and the papacy, but even more prominently between the Byzantine Empire and the papacy. So at the beginning of our period here, we finally get sort of what's described as the cutoff between Roman Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy. And we've been building up to it for a long time, you know, all the way back to the Church Fathers. We've been talking about, all the way from the early Church Fathers, we've been talking about how the Latin Western Christians and the Greek Eastern Christians were developing these different ecclesiastical cultures. Well, it all comes to a head here, and it's usually pinpointed at 1054, what's called the Great Schism. But I want you to be aware that there are things leading up to that. There was another schism a good 200 years before. It's called the Photian Schism, where the Patriarch of the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Pope of the Roman Catholic Church excommunicated each other, just like what would happen in 1054. It didn't last too long, though. They were butting heads over the administration of these new territories in what's now the Balkans, Bulgaria, Serbia, and so on. They each wanted kind of their brand of Christianity to hold sway over the churches that were being planted in this new region. And so that was one of the points of tension. There were a couple other things going on as well. One of them was the papacy's just escalating claims. You see, the Pope of Rome had always been described as the first among equals. You remember back in the age of the Church Fathers, we talked about the four or the five great patriarchal sees, the seats of those bishops. And you had Jerusalem, and you had Antioch and Alexandria and Rome. And because of historical circumstances, Jerusalem faded, Constantinople emerged. But you had these five great patriarchs of the church. And Rome was always listed as first among equals because that was both the imperial capital for most of that time and because Peter and Paul had ended their ministries there. But at this time, you kind of get to see the difference between the way people are thinking about it. The Roman papacy really wanted it to be the first among equals. And the Eastern Orthodox were thinking about it more as the first among equals, right? They're emphasizing different parts of this same idea. So the Pope develops what is called this idea of primacy. And there's some interesting historical things that go into it. The Western Christians came up with a document they were able to start passing around, which was purportedly written by Constantine himself, the great Emperor Constantine, which declared that the Bishop of Rome, the Pope, really was to be the single prime leader of the whole church. It's a document referred to as the Donation of Constantine. Well, the Eastern Orthodox didn't know what to do with this because they'd never seen it or heard of it before. This is 500, 600 years after Constantine, and suddenly you have this document that is written by him. Well, as it turns out, that was a hoax. Constantine never wrote it. As we would call it today, it was a piece of fake news. But the Bishop of Rome really latched onto it and said, no, look, we really are supposed to be the number one, sort of the monarch reigning over the whole church. Whereas the Eastern Orthodox view has always been, we have this whole college of bishops. And the Pope of Rome is honored in the first place. He has the first position in terms of respect, but we're all equals. So they had all these different opinions about those sorts of things. And there are some good stories in your textbook, Bruce Shelley, about the way that the Pope was emphasizing his power, exercising power during this period, not only trying to do so over the Byzantines, but over the nation states in the West as well. It talked about, you know, how the Pope wielded these two weapons of excommunication on the one hand, that he could threaten kings and princes, hey, if you don't toe the line and do what I tell you, then I'm kicking you out of the church. And essentially, to the medieval Christian, that was a threat of taking away salvation in the way that they were starting to conceive of it at that time. The other weapon was the interdict, and that was not against one person, that's against a whole nation. The Pope could say, okay, France, if you're not going to play along with how I want you to play along, then I'm going to basically shut down all the churches. People can still get baptized and have last rites, but you won't have any access to the worship of the church, the sacraments, communion, any of these things that are so important to you. And so the Pope was able to wield this immense power, sort of kingly power, over these other kings. Well, it all comes to a head in the East with the Great Schism in 1054. Remember I told you how the Norsemen, the Vikings, had come in here, Sicily and Naples, southern Italy. They had set up their own kingdom down there, and the Pope didn't like this. You see here around Rome, this is an area called the Papal States. So the Pope wasn't just a church leader at this point in history. He actually was the monarch of a physical territory. The Pope had his own country that he ran, essentially, much of central Italy. And he didn't like having the Norsemen down here. And so one of the things that he wanted was for the Byzantine emperor to help him out, to help me get these Norsemen out of there. The Byzantines weren't too happy with the Pope either on their side, and it was also because of southern Italy. One of the things that the Pope had threatened to do was to shut down all the Greek-speaking churches in southern Italy. And there were a lot of them. There's a lot of Greek influence down there. Well, so one side's threatening to shut down the other's churches, one side's threatening to, or the other side is wanting help getting rid of a political opponent. There's lots of politics that go into this. What happened was that the Pope sent his legate, a representative, over to Constantinople to talk to the Patriarch of Constantinople about getting some of this help. And it didn't go well. The papal legate was a man with just a terrible temper. He really should not have been the one who was sent. Discussions did not go well. Everybody got offended. And what ended up happening is the papal legate excommunicated the Patriarch of Constantinople. And for good measure, the Patriarch excommunicated the Pope, right the other way. So basically, the leaders of the two biggest parts of the Christian church have just agreed that they're kicking each other out of the church, as it were. This is what we call the Great Schism of East and West. Roman Catholic Church on one side, Eastern Orthodoxy on the other side. And this date is one that you'll see figured pretty prominently, 1054. One of the interesting things about it, though, is that if you talk to most people in 1054, they wouldn't have been aware that that's the date of the Great Schism. They knew that the West and the East had their ups and downs. This had all happened before. They still kind of thought of themselves as the same Christian family, and we're going to work it out eventually. So most people at that time didn't actually consider the Great Schism to be the definitive cutoff point. Things continued to spiral from there, though. During the Crusades, we'll talk about this in a moment, a Latin army, a Roman Catholic army, instead of attacking targets further south in Palestine, laid siege to Constantinople, the capital, the center of Eastern Orthodoxy, and conquered Constantinople. The sack of Constantinople, 1204 AD. That did not help to soothe the tensions between East and West, as you can imagine. Even despite all that, the Byzantines got their capital back. Even despite all that, we should know that this really was, in some ways, a golden age for Eastern Orthodox Christianity. It wasn't a golden age for the Byzantine Empire. They were losing territory right and left. But it was for the church. The Eastern Orthodox Church really bloomed and flowered during this period. And if you read their theology, you'll find that they're always referring to not only the early church fathers, but people who lived and worked in the 1200s and the 1300s. Gregory Palamas is one of their great theologians, and he was one who flourished during this time. They had a great revival of monastic spirituality. If you ever get a chance to look at pictures of the monasteries on Mount Athos, A-T-H-O-S in Greece, beautiful, stunning scenery, but it's this island with monasteries built up on tops of these cliffs, and it's kind of the center of Eastern Orthodox monasticism to this day, a really vibrant spiritual center, and that really took shape during this period as well. The cutoff point for most of the people who lived during the time was actually all the way into the 15th century, the 1400s. So when we get to the 1430s and 1440s, the Byzantine Empire has been whittled down by Muslim armies, the Ottoman Turks coming in from this way. And basically, almost all that's left is just the city itself, Constantinople. And so now the Byzantines really are looking for help from outside. And so at this point, they appeal to Rome again and say, look, we'll sign whatever you guys need us to sign. And so they went over, and there was an ecumenical council held at Florence in Italy, where basically the Pope said, okay, you've got to sign off on the supremacy of the Pope and the way we say the creed now, and all these different things where the West had started to do things differently from the East. And the Byzantine representatives signed it. Said, okay, we'll do it, as long as you come and save Constantinople. But here's the thing, when they returned to Constantinople and to what was left of the Byzantine Empire, the people, the lay people, rejected it out of hand. They did not want to have anything to do with this council. They said, look, if that's the price to pay, it is a price too high. We can't go back on our conscience that way. And so final cutoff point was the Council of Florence, 1430s, 1440s. After that, there really has been no serious progress towards keeping Eastern Orthodox and Roman Catholics together to this day. Who knows? It might happen within our lifetimes if they come back. There are some people working and thinking about that. I don't know if it's likely to happen, though. Okay, so that's kind of your broad brushstroke of some of the major ups and downs, especially about East and West during this whole time period. So we just went through from 1000 to about 1500. And I want to make this clear just so it's not confusing to us. I'm going to treat this period of history kind of looking at the same chronology several times over. We're just doing it with a different focus each time. So that first focus kind of gives you the big picture, what East and West were doing. Now we're going to back up chronologically, go back the 11th, and what's happening with what we call the Crusades. So let me see here. I'm going to stop the share for a second so I can bring up a different map for you. So,
probably recognize it. This is the biblical land. This is the Eastern Mediterranean. So you have what's now Israel down here, Sinai Peninsula, Egypt would be over to the left, Arabia, Jordan would be over here to the right, Lebanon would be here, Syria, portions of Turkey up here. This is the area where the Western Christian powers launched the Crusades. And so this is what the Crusader states look like after that first wave of Crusades that come through. I want to take a few minutes to go over the Crusades with you guys because, well, for two reasons. One is that they really are one of the things that set the stage for the Reformation, which is important in our tradition. The second reason is because you hear a lot of historical misinformation about the Crusades. And I think it's helpful to know what they really were and what really happened during that time period, just so you're not kind of led astray or swayed one way or the other from what you might hear out there in the world today. So one of the modern ways that the Crusades are talked about, and you'll find this amongst secular people, Muslims, as well as many Christians, is just to lament that the Crusades ever happened. That this was a horrible, terrible thing that never, ever should have been done. And that from the Muslim point of view, it's often held up as an example of just the worst kind of violent, aggressive Western colonialism, imperialism, trying to put its stamp on these Muslim countries. A couple things to say about that. One is that, and this is true of all of history, history is just way too messy to actually apply well to most of the propaganda narratives that we want to spin nowadays. It just doesn't hold up to scrutiny in quite that way. Speaking for me personally, and for most, I think, Christian scholars, should the Crusades have been launched in the way they were? No, probably not. They were inadvisable, to say the least. And did they also include some truly heinous crimes? Yes, they did. But the other flip side of that is, that's also medieval warfare, right? That's kind of the way the world was back then. So the idea that this is just an example of Western colonialist imperialism, that in particular is not a good historical argument, just so you know. Honestly, it's probably not worth getting into fights with anyone about. The Crusades are not particularly important to us as Baptists or really to the gospel, so it's probably not a fight worth fighting. But it's just interesting to me as a historian, thinking about it, that that way of looking at the Crusades as like a first example of Western European imperialism, it's not the way that anyone back then thought about it. It's not the way that anyone thought about the Crusades until the late 1800s. Even Muslims didn't talk about the Crusades that way until the late 1800s, probably because the late 1800s were when they really were feeling Western colonial imperialism. And so they kind of have this retrojection to go did this once before. But the truth is, no one perceived it that way at the time. Partly because everyone knew, Muslims and Christians alike, that this was contested territory. This was territory that had only recently belonged to the Byzantine Empire, to a Christian empire. So Muslims at the time would say, hey, this is our territory, sure. But they themselves knew they had just taken the territory from Christian nations not that much long before. What happened in the launch of the Crusades, it really began with a call for help from the Byzantine Empire. You see, the Byzantine Empire used to control this whole territory, and they were particularly strong up here in what's now Turkey. But you can see even from this map, that's not the Byzantine Empire anymore. That's now called the Sultanate of Rum. That's because even this early on, Muslim groups had come in and conquered much of what had previously been Byzantine heartland. And so the Byzantines, these Eastern Orthodox Christians, they appeal for help to the West, to their brother Christian kingdom. Say, can you help us recapture some of this territory we've lost? And so you have this political reason. You also have a religious reason in a way, and that is that the Holy Land was important to Christians because of pilgrimage. Western Christians would continue to go on pilgrimage to Israel, and conditions had deteriorated to the point where the safety of those pilgrims really couldn't be assured anymore.
So this problem had developed where a lot of the Western Christian powers were starting to feel some responsibility to say, hey, we need to find a way to make sure our citizens, our people, are safe when they want to go on pilgrimage to the Holy Land. So part of it was to ensure their safety. Because the truth is, all this territory had kind of broken down, and you can even see it on this map. You don't have just one Muslim caliphate over everything. You have multiple different little Muslim principalities all over the place. It wasn't just a war of Christians versus Muslims. It was a war of all these varied Western Christian powers against a whole collection of different Muslim powers. The ones they called the Saracens at the beginning, sort of Arab tribes. And then you get what they called the Seljuks, who were Turks. And you got the Fatimids and the Mamelukes coming from down out of Egypt. A very diverse area and a very complex set of history. So anyway, all that to say, there's a lot of complexity in this history that unfortunately gets missed in much of the telling nowadays. So they put out the call to get the Western Christian powers to help, and the Pope thought this was a good idea. And they had a few preachers kind of going around and stirring up crowds and saying, let's go do this. Let's go help our brothers and sisters, our Eastern Christians, and recapture the Holy Land. And it was an idea that really kind of caught people's fancy. They thought this was a great adventure, a chivalrous adventure. And so you did. You had major participation by the great powers of Europe. You had great crowds of people joining in to come and go. And there was also another reason why people were so keen on doing it. It was because the Pope had invented a whole new trick. And this new trick was to promise what are called indulgences. In the past, you can have forgiveness of sins in the medieval Catholic way of doing things. You can have forgiveness of sins by confessing your sins and going through penance and all that kind of stuff. But now the Pope says, we're going to give you blanket forgiveness for all of your sins. Basically, a guaranteed pass to heaven if you go on crusade and help out this effort. Well, that's an appeal that's really too hard to turn down for many of these folks. And so they took it up. And this sets a precedent, the giving of indulgences by the papacy to say, you know, if you do this particular thing for us, then we'll wipe out all your sins. That becomes one of the big issues that the Protestant Reformation is going to address when it comes around. So anyway, you had these major crowds getting ready to go and attack the what are now Muslim regions in the Eastern Mediterranean. Unfortunately, along the way, there was really terrible, terrible violence done against many of the Jews of Europe. It was a time of really deep anti-Semitism, to the great shame of the gospel. A lot of these crowds that were just kind of whipped up into a frenzy, they took it out on many of the Jewish communities as they were passing by in Europe, with really, really devastating consequences. When they eventually reached the Eastern Mediterranean, they were wildly successful. The First Crusade succeeded in reconquering this entire area, which is why you see all of Israel, Lebanon, much of Syria is now in Latin Christian hands. They conquer Jerusalem in, I think it's 1099, and set up a kingdom there, the Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem. And from that place, hold on here, I'm going to move from the map in a moment, but you can see they have the Kingdom of Israel here, the Kingdom of Jerusalem. They have what they call the County of Tripoli, which is based in Lebanon now. Principality of Antioch. The two big ones were Antioch and Jerusalem, major kingdoms for a long time. Edessa as well over here, but that'll run into trouble as you'll see. One of the interesting things about the Crusades is that they came out to help the Byzantines, but when all these German and French and English princes got to Israel and conquered it for themselves, they decided, hey, you know what? We don't have to give this back to the Byzantines. We can just set up our own kingdom. So that's why these are called the Latin kingdoms, the Crusader states, because many of them stayed. Many of them did not go home. They stayed and settled and kind of had it for their own for a while. I've got a few pictures to share with you here. Hold on just a second. I'm going to bring up one. So a few years ago, I was able to go to Jerusalem. And if you're over there in Israel, you will sometimes see a flag flying. And I'll show you a picture of it here. You'll see this flag flying over a number of pilgrimage sites. And this is actually the flag of the old Kingdom of Jerusalem, the Crusader state. It's still in use by the Franciscans, the Roman Catholics who administer as custodians some of the holy sites in Jerusalem. And let's see, you also have, can you guys see that picture of a church interior? This is also in Jerusalem. This is one of the remaining Crusader churches in Jerusalem. It's the Church of St. Anne. One of the churches they built there during the Kingdom of Jerusalem. And they had this really in hand for 200 years. So we tend to think of the Crusades as this wave that kind of went and then went back to Europe. But in point of fact, they built a nation, a government there that lasted 200 years. And I mean, that's not insignificant. That's, you know, from the American Revolution to 1976. That's a good chunk of history. And these Latin kingdoms, Christian kingdoms, were there in the Holy Land during that time and built up a quite an interesting civilization. So just this past summer, I was back in Israel on a second trip doing archaeology. This is me with some of my team. And we're there digging out on the side of a Byzantine church. But it's a site that was also used by the Crusaders when they came in. It's on the Sea of Galilee. But this is just to kind of prove that the Crusaders weren't just there to sort of come and conquer and have their way. They really were trying to put down roots and build a society there. What you have, this is the old Byzantine wall on the left side of the picture, Byzantine wall of a church, and an old Byzantine monk would have lived in this cell. But on top of the Byzantine walls, the Crusaders have come in and they built their own walls. So this little wall on the right is a Crusader wall. They were using this area, which is over the biblical town of Bethsaida. They were using it as a sugar factory. They were raising sugarcane, products like that, and processing it there. So this was some of the pottery we found in our site. Nice, beautiful yellow glaze and green glaze. These are pieces that came from the Crusader sugar factory, from the pots that they were using to process the sugar that they were growing there on the Sea of Galilee. So that just gives you a little glimpse into some of the culture that they had while they were there. As it turned out, though, let me bring my map back up for you here. Okay. The Crusader states did not enjoy great success for long. This is about the extent of their power, but after this, it all went south. So Edessa was the first major one to fall. Edessa and what's called Little Armenia up here. They fell in 1144. So this is just, 40 years after the First Crusade, essentially. By this point, you had had the kingdom in Jerusalem for a while. You're into your second generation of Latin rulers. And you had certain special features developing, what we call the military monastic orders. You've probably heard of the Knights Templar. They're famous of conspiracy theories nowadays. But they were really, at least at the beginning, they were just a group of Christian knights who banded together in Jerusalem for the defense of pilgrims. And they're called Templars because they had their headquarters on the Temple Mount. In fact, they used some of the space of what's called Solomon's Stables on the inside of the Temple Mount as part of their headquarters operation. If you ever get to go to the Temple Mount, by the way, of course you have the Muslim Dome of the Rock there, but on the other side of the Temple Mount, it's now used as a mosque, is the Crusader Palace of King Baldwin, King of Jerusalem. And it was also at one time Templar headquarters, now a mosque, as I say. But it's still there today. The Templars, you had another group called the Hospitallers, the Knights of St. John. And they're called the Hospitallers because their original function was to set up hospitals and care for the wounded. And then you had a group of German knights called the Teutonic Knights, who also established themselves there in defense of the Latin kingdoms. And each of these have their own story as they go on. The Templars don't last too much longer. After the Crusades, they become very wealthy because they run sort of a primitive banking system across Europe. And because of their great wealth and a few other things about them, they were subjected to persecution and disbanded by the Catholic Church. The only one, to my knowledge, that you can still find around is the Hospitallers, the Knights of St. John. They're still an order of Catholic knights that live on the island of Malta in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea. So there's a little piece of trivia for you. Well, in the second, with the fall of Edessa and Armenia, you got the launch of a second crusade of powers from Western Europe sending armies to try to recapture things in this area. They didn't have much success in the Second Crusade. Then you get the major challenge, which is an Arab general named Saladin. And Saladin effectively conquers the Kingdom of Jerusalem. He takes Jerusalem back in 1187. And this is really what sparks a major movement in Europe. So the First Crusade was a huge movement. The Third Crusade is a huge movement too, because they've just lost Jerusalem and they want to get it back. And so again, major kings of Europe, King Louis of France, Barbarossa of the Holy Roman Empire, and King Richard the Lionhearted from England, they sign up to go on this crusade to try to get Jerusalem back again. So in the Robin Hood stories, when King Richard the Lionhearted is always off somewhere else and King John is doing his thing, messing things up in England, this is where Richard the Lionhearted was. He was off fighting the Third Crusade. It had a little bit more success than the Second Crusade did, but it wasn't entirely successful. The Third Crusade did not make it all the way to Jerusalem. Richard the Lionhearted was able to negotiate safe passage for pilgrims, things like that, but did not succeed in retaking Jerusalem. And that's, in fact, they never did again after that. Several other crusades were launched in the 1200s. I already mentioned the Fourth Crusade didn't even make it this far. They just laid siege to Constantinople and sacked that city. And there were several others along the way. I think they number at least 8 major crusades and several minor ones as well. And none of them really hit the mark after that. By the end of that period, the 1200s, this region is getting seriously destabilized anyway by the incursions of Mongol invaders. Genghis Khan and the Mongols from Central Europe are sweeping through all of Asia at this time, and they get part of the way into Eastern Europe, and they get part of the way down here as well, right up to as far as Antioch and Syria and all these places. And they don't last long themselves, but the groups of the Mongols who conquered this region eventually convert to Islam. And when they do, they take out their aggression on the Christian churches. And so one of the later Mongol conquerors, who's called Tamerlane, he in particular just hunted down Christians from the Church of the East and drove them almost out of existence single-handedly. Tremendously terrible thing. In the end, you have this region has to be abandoned. The European presence here just doesn't remain. It can't hold its foothold here. And in fact, it slips even farther. After these Crusader states fall, you get the threats once again against Constantinople and the Byzantine Empire. And we already looked a little bit at their desperate plea to the West to help them when they were kind of on their last legs there at the Council of Florence. And let me bring that other map back up here. So Constantinople is here in this little peninsula of the Byzantine Empire. The Ottoman Turks were invading by the 1400s, and basically Constantinople was all that was left. And in 1453, the city fell. And that's the end of the Byzantine Empire. 1453, it falls. Eastern Orthodoxy survives, but it doesn't have a capital city anymore. And really, it's worth saying, when Constantinople falls, that's the end of a 2,000-year-old civilization that began in the old Roman Republic, with Romulus and Remus and all those guys. The Roman Republic became the Roman Empire, which then moved its capital, but it was still the Roman Empire, the Eastern Roman Empire, that we called the Byzantine Empire, and it persisted till 1453, 2,000 years of uninterrupted history. But it does fall at that point, and the Ottoman Turks take over that region and set up their Ottoman Empire. Just a couple other notes. The Crusade didn't have much effect, no lasting effect, in the Eastern Mediterranean, but it did spark off a series of movements that had lasting effects in Europe. So the Teutonic Knights, who had their beginnings there, they went back to Germany, and they undertook basically some kind of military campaigns into Eastern Europe, Poland, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, this area, and brought that whole region under the sway of Christianity. Not necessarily with the best missionary practices, mind you, because they were invading knights. But you have, those are sometimes termed the Baltic Crusades. And then you had another wave of the Crusade, which we call the Reconquista, which is the recapture of Spain from Islam. Muslims had ruled Spain for almost 700 years by this point. But Christian powers just kept chipping away, and little by little, leading up to the end of the 1400s, they were finally able to push the Muslim powers completely out of Spain and Portugal and back across into North Africa. So the Crusades were I think, regrettable in a lot of ways. It probably was not the best idea to undertake them. But it's important to understand them because they really did have a major role in shaping the world that we know today. So